Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Last week marked the 45th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade ruling. The 7-2 decision gave women control over their bodies with a constitutional right to choose to have an abortion. Last week, we spoke with women who remember what life was like before abortion was legal. And today, we are continuing that discussion with Jody Jacobson, president and editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication focused on health, reproductive rights, and justice. Yesterday, Rewire reported on the unconstitutional Trump administration-backed 20-week abortion ban, which went down in the Senate. But it still got 51 votes, 3 from Democrats. The White House formally endorsed the bill, which is based on anti-choice myths about abortion care. Rewire covers a wide array of topics: transgender parents scrambling to find care in Indiana, pregnant inmates or an overcrowded and hungry in Oklahoma prisons, women and families are becoming unhealthier in New Jersey after healthcare budget cuts in New Jersey. This is just a glimpse of the stories you can find at rewire.news. It's a site that documents the latest developments in sexual and reproductive rights and justice. Jody Jacobson has been on the show many times, and I'm so glad that she is in studio. She's in the Bay Area because she's participating in a Forum for Choice. It's an event tonight, a live debate. It'll also be online between California's candidates for governor. Every candidate running says that they will be there tonight. And if you'd like to go, it's at 934 Brannan Street, SOMARTS Cultural Center. It's from 6 to 8. It'll also be live streamed, and you can find ticket information at yourcallradio.org. And Jody Jacobson joins me in studio. Hi, Jody. It's so great to meet you in person.
It's so good to be here. I can't tell you how happy I am. Really, I am. So delighted to be here.
Well, I have so much respect for the work you do, and it's hard enough to keep up with all the issues that are happening, but even just on reproductive justice, looking at your website and reading about trans rights and pregnant inmates and immigrants who are in jail who are pregnant. I mean, there's so much going on just on this issue.
Yes. I think it's a microcosm of the broader set of issues that we face, right? It's fundamentally about people's rights to self-determination. And so anything that's outside the sort of male, white male norm is to be controlled. And that's what we see in the right wing of the Republican Party, or the right wing that is the Republican Party. So it's not really surprising that across the board at the state level and at the federal level, there are increasing efforts to control women's bodies, to control the bodies of LGBTQ persons, in fact, to dehumanize people, very much so, like leaving LGBTQ people out of the census, for example, is a function of dehumanizing people. And we see that with immigrants as well, where the Republican Party and the far right want to dehumanize immigrants. So I think all of this comes down to an effort to use law and policy to take control away from individuals of their bodies as a form of dehumanizing them, and also as a form of changing the demographic destiny of the country.
What has struck you the most about the Trump administration and how it is rolling back rights for women, LGBT people, immigrants, specifically when we're talking about reproductive justice and health?
Well, first of all, it's the Trump-Pence administration. And I want to emphasize that because, you know, Donald Trump was elected with a very strong support from white evangelicals. They have an extraordinarily retrograde view as a voting bloc of women, of LGBTQ persons, of reproduction, of women's role in society. So I think it's really, while Trump was elected by these folks, he is not personally, I don't think, as invested as the people around him, the Pences, the John Kellys, in making policies that control people's bodies and their lives. So I think what struck me the most but not surprised me is the rapid advance of so-called religious freedom as a way of impinging on people's ability to use contraception. So the rollback of access to contraception is one piece of that. The expansion of so-called conscience rights in providing healthcare is another piece of that. The expansion of it's not really a federal government effort, but you have an underlying expansion of takeover of hospitals and clinics in large catchment areas by Catholic hospitals, for example. So you combine these kind of federal policies where people can deny people medically, care based on medically sound research and public health principles. They can deny large swaths of people care, and they don't have to refer them either. And you have a large community system that's suddenly wiped out because no one in that system will refer or provide contraception, abortion, STD testing, transgender care. We're seeing that become really problematic. So I think it's that expansion of what really is, I don't think people really recognize it, but it's a religious takeover of the healthcare system. And it's happening on so many levels and so quickly, I don't really think people perceive it as such yet.
What do we need to know about who's really calling the shots? Because as you said, I mean, Donald Trump has changed his views on abortion so many times. He'll say something about DACA and then people in his cabinet will say he didn't really mean that. So when you look at the relationship between Trump and Pence and the evangelicals, who now has a seat at that table? Who's really calling the shots here?
Well, I mean, Trump is corrupt in his own way, and he's very problematic for a lot of reasons, but he doesn't know or read any of this stuff. So I think it's Pence that's calling the shots. I think Pence is bringing in all of the evangelical leaders. You've got, groups like the Heritage Foundation. You've got the Thomas More Society. You've got all of these different outside groups that are creating lists of regulations and policies they want to put in place, people they want at HHS, people they want in other positions. And I really think he's running that show. And it's kind of his wet dream come true, if you will. I mean, it's what he did in Indiana. And in Indiana, what we're seeing now is, really tremendous healthcare disparities in the wake of Pence's governorship. Things like, increasing maternal mortality, infant mortality, rather, among infants of color in that state because of the policies that he put in place. So the legacy of those policies is showing up in Indiana, and now they're taking them national.
The other thing is it's not just obviously at the national level, because since the Obama administration, Democrats lost 900 seats in state legislatures across the country. And since then, we have seen the same thing happen at the state levels.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. The states have become really, it's their laboratory for one thing, I think it was under the Obama administration that the right wing realized that they couldn't get as much as they wanted at the national level. So they took it to the states and they introduced bill after bill after bill, whether or not there was any science or evidence or anything behind it. In fact, even when there was evidence of a positive outcome, let's say in Colorado, where the state was funding a family planning program that was helping really created a precipitous drop in teen pregnancies. The Republicans went after that and decided to defund it for a while until it was refunded again by the Congress by the state legislature. So you see that even where you're getting positive health outcomes, you have problematic policies that go against the grain of what public health gains you would want to make in those areas. Why would you want to have more teen pregnancies? Well, there's got to be a reason behind that, right? So at the state level, yes, there has been an onslaught of legislation banning abortion, creating obstacles to abortion. It's the playbook that says, we can gut Roe without overturning Roe. And effectively, they've done that because in many states and counties, there are no abortion providers left. And it's very, very difficult for women to get access to abortion.
What are you hearing from clinics across the country? We've done a lot of shows about this with you. There's one clinic in Mississippi. I've spoken to women in Texas who are working with young girls whose parents might not give them permission to have an abortion. And you have to get permission from a judge. Some judges say no across the board, regardless of circumstance. And in some cases, these lawyers say they have no choice but to fly these girls to other states to have this procedure.
So the first thing I want to say is that the people that run particularly independent abortion clinics, but also Planned Parenthood clinics, are some of the most brave, courageous people you will find anywhere, because they are providing care to people in need, literally, in many cases, literally under terrorist conditions. They've got people outside their clinics every day. Their clinics get bomb threats. They've got people who call in to their personal homes, you know, attack their children outside schools. So these are brave people. They're doing the work of public health and medical, living the ethics of public health and medicine. But yes, you're right. I mean, this is the irony of the thing. Look at the right wing has pushed for judicial bypass for teens to get the right wing has pushed for parental notification of teens to get an abortion, right? And then they pressed also for judges to have to oversee certain things.
Right.
But now even when judges approve an abortion, like a case in Texas that we've reported on, they will then fight that to say, no, we don't want this young girl to get an abortion. Or you've got a situation that we uncovered through investigative reporting in Mississippi where a young girl who was pregnant had decided with her mom that she wanted to get an abortion. And she relayed that to her teacher, who apparently was affiliated with the pro-life movement. The teacher then called in some anti-choice lawyer who had this girl sign a document saying that if I go for an abortion, I'm being coerced. The young girl was actually coerced into signing this document. But once she went to the abortion with her mother, police showed up claiming that her mother was coercing her to get an abortion. So they literally will go around the parent, even though they'll claim that parents have ultimate rights. When it doesn't suit the way they want it to go, they'll actually go around the parent. That was something that we uncovered in investigative research that we did. So it's a really nefarious thing, because I think at the sort of broader level, people think, oh, we have Roe v. Wade, that's not overturned, therefore women still have a right to abortion. You don't have a right if you can't exercise it. You can say that you have a right in name only, but if you can't exercise that right, then you don't have that right, actually. And that's what's happening at the ground level. The disappearance of clinics, the attacks on clinics and doctors, the attacks on individuals who want to access abortion care or even contraceptive care, and the public shaming of those things as though there's something wrong with it.
When you were talking earlier about the teen pregnancy rate going down, was that in Colorado?
Yes.
Yes. Okay. So talk a bit more about this, because I think this deserves so much more attention. There was a big donor who gave a lot of money to clinics and said, you can offer the IUD to any woman or girl who wants one, right? Mm-hmm. And some people were concerned about who they were targeting. Was it young women of color and poor women of color?
Right.
We did a show about that, and we brought on these community clinics, and a number of advocates said, no, that is not what happened. We can understand why people make these assumptions, but we did a lot of counseling with young people. It was not targeted at all.
Right.
So just to get that out there, it was amazing to see the teen pregnancy rate
plummeted by
50%.
Plummeted. Absolutely.
And this is not surprising.
Right. Well, I mean,
but
guess what? Teens have sex.
Right.
Teens have sex. I was a teen. I had sex. And it, you know, that's what teens do. I'm not saying every one of them does, but, you know, and if you want, there's two, you know, there's something in public health that's called reduction of risk. You want to reduce the risk of a bad outcome. That's why we wear seatbelts, right? It doesn't mean we're never going to get in a car accident. But if we get in a car accident, we have an airbag and a seatbelt to help possibly prevent us from getting killed or maimed or whatever. So contraception is a reduction of risk for sex that people don't want to lead to pregnancy. And when you have teen pregnancy, you see particularly focuses on the young women. They are less likely to attain higher education. They're less likely to build a career on a sort of regular path because they have to take care of a baby. They're more likely to end up in low-wage work. They're less likely to have the ability to advocate for themselves. So if you want, young adults to get educated, be able to reach their own potential, whatever that potential is that they see for themselves, why would you want to saddle them with an unwanted or unintended pregnancy? Unless somehow you're punishing them for sex and you want to force them to have babies that they don't want. That's really what's behind it.
I'm looking at an article from the Denver Post, and when this story was breaking, I heard that it was Warren Buffett's family who mm-hmm. funded this. And mm-hmm. it turns yes. out it was Warren Buffett's family. So they spent $28 million over the course of 8 years supplying IUDs to 75 public health clinics throughout the state, several based inside high schools. From 2009 to 2016, the program provided over 43,000 contraceptive implants to women, plus trained medical staff on how to insert the devices. Over that time, the teen birth rate fell 54%. The teen abortion rate declined 64%.
Yes.
Massive.
Yes. Yes. So there you go. You say you want to reduce abortions, but you don't want to give people the tools to do that. There's something wrong there, isn't there? I mean, think about it. And, I think people have a right to be initially concerned because there have been in the past problems with, family planning methods being promoted to certain communities. And I've personally worked on those issues prior in my life, and I always raise those questions myself. Is the consent really informed consent? What is going on there? It so happens I'm a little bit biased in this regard because in that program, one of my closest colleagues and friends was one of the people who oversaw that program. And I know it had a lot of integrity. It was a good program, and it was meant to be a pilot program to show what could happen if you provided high quality care in a setting in which people's really their demand for those methods is there, and that is meeting their demand. So
in this article, Dr. John Douglas, executive director of the Tri-County Health Department in Colorado, said this is one of the biggest public health home runs that I've seen in my 35-year public health career. The work that's happened is really striking. Again, we are talking about $28 million over 8 years.
Yeah.
And look at the outcome. So what happened after that funding?
Well, it got politicized by what the whole idea was that if you proved the concept and you showed success, which obviously there was, then the legislature would take over paying for the program and hopefully also encourage other legislatures to take over similar programs in their states. And it got politicized. So the Republicans started to fight against the money being put forward for the program. Later on, it did happen that the program was funded. But again, it's the constant fighting around proven public health interventions that is both exhausting and a lost opportunity, because we're talking not just about numbers. We're talking about individual people's lives that are affected in adverse ways. And it's not for nothing that the CDC calls contraception, the spread of contraceptions, one of the greatest public health interventions of the 20th century. I mean, it's not for nothing that that's recognized, because it is. It reduces maternal mortality, reduces abortion, it reduces teen pregnancy, it improves health in so many other ways, obviously when it's voluntary and meets the demand of individuals.
We have a caller who couldn't stay on the air, and she wanted you to elaborate when you said that there's got to be a reason. Why did the legislature not vote to continue with the funding? Why would they want teen pregnancies to go back up?
So we live in a country right now where in so many areas, climate change, I'm going to space out on all the different ones, but there's so many areas where ideology takes precedence over evidence and facts. And it seeps into the media and it seeps everywhere. And there's no place where ideology takes precedence over facts than in the area of sexual and reproductive justice. Because you've got people that are more concerned with their own ideology and their own efforts to either punish people for sex, to dehumanize LGBTQ persons. And so even though you can show the evidence says that there is great outcomes with these kinds of interventions, ideology takes precedence. And that's why the GOP in Colorado even voted against it.
Well, I hope you can read about this because it's really an amazing story. And so the funding's gone?
No, the funding's been restored now, I think, by the legislature.
It has.
Yeah.
And are they going to fund it for how many years?
That I don't know. I'd have to look. I'm not totally up on that stuff.
Like you said, they voted against it, and then it got national attention.
Yeah.
Jody Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication focused on health, rights, and justice. And Jody is in town for the Forum for Choice. It is a debate between California's candidates for governor, and they will all be at the event tonight talking about reproductive justice. It's from 6 to 8 at SOMART's Cultural Center, 934 Brannan Street in San Francisco. You can find ticket information. Are tickets still available?
I don't know.
Okay.
Honestly,
I think they are, last time I checked.
Just one thing, though, that apparently all of the top four candidates were invited from both parties, but only Democrats accepted. So it won't be all the candidates.
Oh, okay, thank you. Only Democrats accepted. They will be there tonight, and it'll also be live streamed. We've got a link on our website, yourcallradio.org. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Now I would like to welcome Amanda Kifferly to the show. Amanda is executive director for abortion access at the Women's Centers. They have clinics around the country, and Amanda is joining us from New Jersey. Hi, Amanda. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Amanda.
Hi, Rose. Hi, Jody. Thank you guys so much. It's a pleasure to join you.
Well, it's great to have you. I understand that the Women's Centers run clinics in five states, from Georgia to Connecticut.
That's right. Mm-hmm.
And yeah. What changes? I mean, even this did not start with the Trump administration. I mean, we are seeing attacks on abortion and women's health. But what changes really concern you the most? What have you seen over the last year that concerns you?
I think Jody did a great job of helping to introduce us, and certainly Rewire touches on this constantly. Thank goodness. Thank you for that, Jody. So I think over the past few years, and specifically over the past year, what I have seen is definitely an increase in protester experiences outside of the clinics, making the actual climate for our patients really feel heated and sometimes violent. So I would definitely say that that has increased and been a major factor for all of our centers. And then I'd also want to continue to always talk about the access. There's such alarming statistics discussing how many counties in the United States do not have an abortion care provider, and the distances that people have to travel, and what that means within their own lives in order to access a fundamental health care option. So those are the two major issues that I see consistently at all of our centers.
We have done a lot of shows about how anti-choice activists have been empowered under the George W. administration and now under the Trump administration. Amanda, what kind of protections do clinic workers have in some of the states that you work in?
Well, there's no one answer to that. I think it depends for our centers. It depends which state, and there's different climates there. And we're what Jody referred to earlier as an independent abortion provider. And so there can be different opportunities for accessing the ability to fund those types of positions or those needs that look different in Atlanta, and they'd look different in Connecticut. For instance, in Connecticut, right next door to our center, a crisis pregnancy center moved in and immediately bought the name very similar to our office in an attempt to confuse and lure patients away from us and into their office. That's also then given them access to our patients by sharing a public walkway and giving them the opportunity to put, you know, negative words out there, to put really ugly signs in their faces, and to cause a bunch of disruption for our staff. and for the actual flow of the day. So there are different needs throughout the country when it comes to that.
Amanda, can you stay with us for a couple more minutes? I'd like to ask you more about the crisis pregnancy centers.
I'd love that, Rose. Thanks so much.
Great. Thank you. Amanda Kifferly is Executive Director for Abortion Access at the Women's Centers. They have clinics with locations in 5 states, from Georgia to Connecticut. We're joined in studio today by Jody Jacobson, President and Editor-in-Chief of Rewire, an online publication focused on health, reproductive rights, and justice. This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we will talk about immigration, immigrants who have lived in the U.S. for the majority of their lives or have fled dangerous conflicts, are being deported, and in many cases, they no longer have connections to their home countries. We are now getting reports that ICE is arresting people after they drop their kids off at school or when they show up for their regular ICE check-ins. We will speak with immigrants tomorrow about these arrests and these deportations, and we'll find out how they are responding. And then coming up on Thursday, investigative journalist David K. Johnston will be in studio to talk about his new book, It's Even Worse Than You Think, What the Trump Administration is Doing to America. Today, we are talking about reproductive justice and reproductive health. We did a show last week to mark the 45th anniversary of the Roe v. Wade ruling with a panel of women. Some remember what life was like before abortion was legal, and you can find that show at yourcallradio.org. We're continuing that conversation with Jody Jacobson, who's president and editor-in-chief of Rewire, an online publication focused on health, reproductive rights, and justice. We're also joined by Amanda Kifferly, Executive Director for Abortion Access at the Women's Centers, a group of abortion care clinics with locations in 5 states from Georgia to Connecticut. Amanda, you mentioned crisis pregnancy centers, which we have here in California. In fact, the Supreme Court is taking up a decision specifically around crisis pregnancy centers in California this year. Can you give our listeners just an overview of what these centers are?
Sure. I think Jody will probably fill in some really great anything I missed on this, because she's covered it so widely. So the crisis pregnancy centers have sprung up over the years. We've all seen them, and they generally started as offshoots of maybe college campuses and usually Catholic faith-based organizations on campus, and started offering what they were referring to as alternatives to abortion. What we see it as now is what it is, and it's clearly a coercion into forcing people into parenthood when they may not be prepared, or neglecting to offer patients the full range of options. And then they're advertising as if they are a medical clinic or a facility that's open to conversations about the full spectrum of parenting, including options like abortion. So every day, sadly, I hear from patients who have been misled by those organizations. They outnumber abortion clinics in many states at a ratio that's 3-1, which for rural areas, for folks who are coming from disproportionately low-income neighborhoods, can be really upsetting, because it becomes the only option for health care, and it is not health care. So it's not uncommon for me to meet with a patient who's under the assumption that they can no longer be treated with an abortion, or that they couldn't afford an abortion, or you mentioned earlier the myths that often come with anti-abortion work, which is, you know, abortion causes different health conditions that we know not to be true. And so our patients are very often coming in with misinformation, and it's affecting the outcome of their pregnancy. I've seen it affect the outcome of patients choosing to parent, and I've seen it affect the outcomes of people who are choosing to have an abortion. It limits not only what type of abortion they can have or where they can have it, but may force them to take off more time from their home and family, travel outside of state, or reach deeper into their pockets to be able to afford the care.
What would you add, Jody? You've done a lot of investigations on these centers.
I mean, Amanda's really covered it. I think, you know, one of the troubling things, first of all, just to underscore what Amanda said, these people actually lie about health outcomes and health care. They pretend to be something they're not. Imagine if you went to a pediatrician that lied to you outright about any range of interventions. But really, also, the other only thing I would add to what Amanda said is that in many states, you've got taxpayer money funding these so-called women's health centers, their fake clinics. And I find that really offensive, because it's one thing if you're going to lie to people. It's another thing for taxpayer dollars to be going into centers that actually lie to people about their health care.
According to the San Francisco Chronicle, there are about 2,500 crisis pregnancy centers nationwide, at least 228 here in California, and the U.S. Supreme Court will decide whether California can require hundreds of these anti-abortion clinics to notify patients that the state of California makes abortion and other reproductive health care available at little or no cost. How important is this Supreme Court upcoming decision, Jody?
I think it's critical. I mean, we've seen these fights in New Jersey and elsewhere where it's sort of a truth in advertising, right? If you are saying or trying to trick someone into the idea that you're providing something and you're not providing that, and it's a medical decision that is time bound, you ought to be forced to tell people that you're not getting this here, you can get it elsewhere. I think it's critical.
Amanda, before we let you go, we have a couple of social media posts saying, what can we do? What is most effective to reverse this gutting of abortion rights?
Well, I think it's vital to pay attention to different news sources who are talking about these issues. The reproductive justice movement is, vastly uncovered. So I think it's important for people to follow media outlets that are giving us the full idea of what's going on, especially with this political administration. I think it's very important to pay attention to the Supreme Court case, and Jody underscored that certainly, because it will have so much effect on the lives of our communities. And this is about making sure that the people in our community and in our families get treated with dignity and with the best possible outcomes. And when we deny them that, it's just a sadness that and a burden we all carry. So I think it's important to pay attention to these issues and to consider them when you're talking to your family, when you're making election decisions, and also when you're giving during your charity time.
Amanda, thank you for joining us. Thank you so much for your work.
Thank you.
Thanks, Amanda.
Amanda Kifferly is Executive Director for Abortion Access at the Women's Centers. That's a group of abortion care clinics with location in five states, from Georgia to Connecticut. And now I would like to welcome Laura Chellian to the show.
Oh,
Laura works with the Northland Family Planning. It's a Michigan-based abortion care and women's health clinic. Hi, Laura. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Rose. Thank you so much for having me. Well, hi, Jody.
Hey, Laura. This is like a surprise party.
Thank you so much for joining us, Laura. It's just important to find out what's going on in other parts of the country. What are you currently facing in Michigan?
Well, I have to say that currently our legislature doesn't seem to be enacting anything this year, but we have already so many laws on the books here in Michigan. I mean, we were the first state in the country to get the 24-hour waiting period. We've had parental consent since 1990, and since then we've had various laws passed that just restrict the access and make it much more difficult for women to access abortion care that they need. We had in 2011 a TRAP bill that was passed, which is a targeted regulation of abortion providers that really limited, it actually closed multiple clinics immediately because they knew they couldn't comply with the laws. And it was basically created a new type of facility that we had to adhere to, even though it wasn't about the safety of patients. It was about benign things such as, the width of your hallways and the candlefoot lighting in the corners of procedure rooms and things like that. So we have been fighting laws nonstop, and we already are living with so many. But what I can say is that in the last year or so, and truly, I hate to keep bringing this up, but since Trump was elected, the emboldenedness of the anti-abortion activists has been greater than ever. The amount of terrorism that we have experienced has been completely on the rise, and it has been horrible in the past year, especially this past fall when one of our clinics, we actually have three clinics in Michigan, and one of our clinics was invaded by these newer tactics. They're called Red Rose invasions. That's what the anti-abortion activists are calling them, and they are literally invading our clinics, coming in, refusing to leave, taking over so that services cannot be provided until they are literally carried out by police officers. And we're currently, you know, waiting on a court case about that. But they are, these Red Rose invasions are skirting the FACE laws, which were the Freedom of Access to Clinic Entrances, the federal act that was passed in the early 90s. So we are seeing these tactics on the increase, and it is putting a level of fear. It's frightening. It's a frightening climate for our staff and for patients, and it's frankly unnerving, but they are very, very emboldened.
Laura, are these men and women, young and old? Who's doing this?
That is correct, actually. It was all of the above. At our clinic, who was arrested was both men and women, and both young, very young, like early 20s, all the way to people in their 50s, maybe 60s. I'm not exactly sure, but it was a group of them. And they were doing this simultaneously across the country. Our clinic just happened to be one of the targets as well.
So they actually come into the clinic physically?
Yes, they physically, you know, timed it so that they just did the most bold acts that they could. And we have, I mean, we have guards on in our parking lots and perusing. So they timed this so that they could at some point just get past. And they came into our clinics and, you know, were confronting patients. And it was a very frightening situation. And they refused to leave until the police had to physically carry them out one by one.
Jody, this is happening across the country?
Yes.
It's the first I've heard of this.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really horrifying. I find it really horrifying.
It's hard enough.
I mean, people like Laura are providing health care.
Well, in San Francisco, for example, in parts of California, in San Francisco on Valencia Street, there's a Planned Parenthood. And I'm seeing more and more people with the signs and things. But here in California, you don't get yelled at like you do. And I've been to the clinic in Mississippi. And when I went in to do interviews, the people outside were yelling at me, "Mommy, don't kill me. How can you do this to me?" I mean, it was so jarring. But then to be in the clinic where you feel like you're in a safe place and it's already, who knows what's going on in your head, right? Your partner might be with you, might not. To have people come into the clinic and yell.
Well, you know, one thing I just want to raise, and Laura probably should give her perspective on this. One thing we found, we did a short documentary called Care in Chaos, and we looked at access to abortion care in two cities, one in North Carolina and one in North Dakota. And what we found in doing that documentary is that the participation of local authorities either in ensuring access and a calm environment outside a clinic or in exacerbating the problem is really key. So that in North Dakota, you had a local police force in Fargo that was committed to keeping basically access open to the clinic and making sure that the protesters had their ability to protest, but that patients were not harassed and that providers were not harassed. Whereas in Charlotte, North Carolina, the police force actually was helping embolden in certain subtle ways the protesters outside. And the city permitting process allowed that. And so I think we really need to look at also how local authorities are or not doing their job to make sure people have access to health care, irrespective of their own personal views on any kind of health care.
What does that look like in Michigan, Lara? When this happened, what were the conversations like with law enforcement? I mean, what happens if this group decides to do this again?
Well, it first of all, depends, and this is why local government involvement and local having a good relationship with your local police force is so vital, in a way that it isn't necessarily vital for other types of small businesses. But we have three different clinics, and they're all in different cities and counties. So we have completely different situations at all three of our clinics. We had our police response for the clinic that this happened in was wonderful, and they were just appalled. And, you know, I mean, it was a clear-cut case of trespassing. The problem is that they like to take these things into court and make them about abortion, which is not what's on trial. It's a, you know, trespass case. and that you, you know, prevented a business from providing services for a period of time until they were removed and things were able to get back in order. I have to say that the clinic that it happened at is not the one where we have the most protester activity. We have another location that has a much higher level of protest activity, and we have some national anti-abortion activists that come there on a regular basis. And it really, in the past summer, actually, seemed to be used as a training ground for them bringing in new people and training them on how to harass and how to picket and how to stop cars and how to stand in front of the driveway without, you know, skirting the laws. We have a great relationship with the police department there, but what happens is whenever the police department acts on violations of the law, these people are greatly funded and have lawyers and attorneys and organizations like Jody mentioned, Thomas More Law Society and others, that will turn around and they'll sue the city. And then they start suing for, you know, the constitutionality of the laws that they were arrested under. And that we have ongoing multiple lawsuits about this. I mean, not personally, but within the cities of our clinics, because they, I think that's part of their goal right now is to get arrested and then try and try and challenge that these laws are not are unconstitutional or unjust or not, you know, and whatever, so that they can try and get them overturned or changed if the local laws aren't written to protect. I mean, they're not written to protect clinic access. That's not the point of, you know, a trespassing law. But when they start to finagle and start to harass people, there's a it's a fine line between, you know, protesting and harassment, and they cross it on a regular basis. But the other thing is if they, we have escorts and security guards that record and video this behavior, but it's the police are overwhelmed by this, and then still have other business to take care of in the city.
Laura, before we let you go, what do you think is most effective at fighting back against this?
Personally, I mean, everything that Amanda said, but I want to reiterate that your vote and the way that you vote and look at issues of how people are going to, that you, elected officials are going to vote on pro-choice versus anti-abortion issues is huge. And in fact, actually, even more important than that, I think when you look at who you're voting for your local government, I cannot stress enough how important it is to even ask about these issues and what are your thoughts on this, because even though they might say that's not something I deal with, in fact, a lot of these things go in front of city councils and a lot of protections that we need to implement to protect clinic workers and patients go in front of the very local government. So they might not have a platform of, you know, I'm pro-choice or anti-abortion, but you need to find out about these things, because if they're not willing to protect the patients, which are the, you know, civilians going into these clinics, and the people who work there, and they're doing a legally needed job and providing a legally necessary service, then I don't think you should vote for them. I think your vote is so much more powerful than you think, especially at the local level. So whoever's running for school boards, find out how they feel about sex education. I mean, I cannot stress the voting and knowing who your elected officials are at every single level makes such a difference.
Well, Laura, thank you so much for joining us, and thank you for your work.
Oh, yeah. Thank you for having me. Thank you so much, and thank you, Jody, for all you do.
Thank you. Thank you.
That is Laura Celli, and she works with Northland Family Planning, a Michigan-based abortion care and women's health clinic. And speaking of voting, Jody Jacobson, editor-in-chief of Rewire, is in town for tonight's Forum for Choice. This group, Rewire and NARAL, invited all candidates running for governor in California. Only the Democrats will be attending tonight. John Chang, Delaine Easton, Gavin Newsom, and Antonia Villaraigosa. The event is from 6 to 8 o'clock at SOMART's Cultural Center, 934 Brannan Street in San Francisco. Find ticket information online. It'll also be live streamed. And we have just a couple minutes left. Let's go to a few callers who've been waiting patiently. Thank you so much. Brad in San Francisco. Hi, Brad.
Hello, Rose. Thank you for letting me speak. I'll go quickly. I just wanted to really congratulate you and thank you both for the making certain to point out that it's the Trump-Pence administration and what a significant role Pence plays. I think other than Samantha Bee, you're the only one who's doing it on a continual basis, which is really important. A little suggestion. Sorry for the background noise. I never can stop working. I'm a union officer. And if there has or has not been, rather, a poll been conducted, I would really recommend that one be where you demonstrate the number of women and the number of men who are supportive of this whole theme. I think that we might be surprised what it might look like at this time. And I know it's a tendency to break it down to age bracket and political party, but I think looking at it first as a whole picture might be very helpful.
Well, thank you, Brad. Thanks for taking a couple minutes out of your work to call us. You make a great point. I'm so glad you brought this up. Jody, we hear in the media that abortion is the most divisive issue of our time, that we're so divided on this. But if you look at polling from NBC, The Wall Street Journal, Pew, 70% of the population supports Roe. Mm-hmm. And if you look at what happens when these extreme measures go to the voters, they always go down. I'd say 98%,
always.
Right?
Always.
Colorado, South Dakota, Mississippi, you name it.
That's my bugaboo. I always bring this
yes,
up.
Yes, and it doesn't get much attention.
Yes.
And this stuff is only passing when it's introduced in legislatures across the country.
That are controlled by far right-wing groups. And I just wanted to mention in all of this, and your caller's right about the polling, that there's also a lot of Koch brothers money in the anti-choice movement. So when Laura was talking about how they're funded for these legal things, that's why you've got these legislatures so lopsided. And that's why I really am hoping that people are going to take their votes seriously at the state level, at the community level, and at the national level.
Where's the Koch money going, and why do the Kochs care about this issue?
I think it's a complicated answer. Bottom line is that they align with the most right-wing positions throughout the party, and they see their advantage in supporting anti-choice legislators in a lot of ways. And so they have funneled money, and we've done, again, investigative reporting on this, funneled money through various organizations that are anti-choice, Susan B. Anthony List and others.
We have a related question about this from Lisa in San Francisco. Hi, Lisa.
Yes, I'm very happy that you're talking about this, and very happy that your guest also spoke about the Koch brothers. I think we should look at the American Legislative Exchange Council,
yes.
which is mm-hmm. a corporate lobbying group within the legislatures of this country, and that's how they've been doing all these different changes. And also the fact that voting rights have been severely affected
yes.
by ALEC, as well as as well as the fact that these same groups support the Stand Your Ground laws that basically justified Trayvon Martin's death, and also many anti-immigrant and also privatization of education. All of these issues are directly linked to this right-wing agenda, and it's really important that reproductive rights be basically more broadened in terms of this and joining forces with the other issues that also affect all of our rights. And I don't agree with polling people or men because it's my body. I don't believe men have any right to tell me or even elect any kind of elections related to my body, a woman's body. And maybe I belong to more of the 1970s style, but I think that we need to get back to doing more clinic defense work that used to happen, that basically was part of the movement that supported women's right to choose.
Well, thank you so much for calling in. I mean, here we are 45 years later after Roe, and every Republican who ran for president opposed abortion, even in cases of rape and incest. They used to never go that far. I mean, I remember when Obama and McCain were running, I called some of the Republican candidates, and they did not want to go on the record to talk about rape and incest. But this time around, they did. And as you point out in the Rewire piece about the Monday vote in the Senate to ban abortion after 20 weeks, it went down in the Senate, but 51 senators voted for it, including three Republicans, Joe Manchin, West Virginia.
Democrats,
thanks. Joe Manchin, West Virginia, Joe Donnelly, Indiana, Bob Casey, Pennsylvania. So, I mean, things have shifted so far to the right, Jody, where you've got every Republican running for president opposes abortion, even in cases of rape and incest.
Yeah.
All right. So people are writing in. How do you fight against? I mean, we've been asking this question for years. What's most effective?
I mean, it's really the same answer. You've got to get involved. You've got to, if you've got any discretionary income, you've got to give it to progressive groups and causes. You've got to do your homework on the people you're voting for. And you've got to be participating. You know, it's a cliche, but democracy doesn't happen by itself. You've got to be participating all the time.
And media coverage. Can you spend a minute talking about that?
Well, obviously, again, I'm a little bit biased because I run a publication. And if you like, you can find us at rewire.news.
How are NPR and the cable shows and the New York Times doing on these issues?
We continue to see problematic reporting, even though we push back on a lot of different media. The same tendency toward giving the benefit of the doubt to anti-choice groups. Let me just give you a specific example. The New York Times piece that covered the vote yesterday, the last paragraph described that the anti-choice movement based their position on several different medical papers, and then said, but the, you know, ACOG and 100 other medical organizations have disputed this. Well, first of all, they're not medical studies of any repute. So the anti-choice movement uses actually fake science, or if you can even call it, I don't even like to say it because it's not science, fake studies. They create their own studies, and then they are, the media treats them as though they're legitimate, which to me is not the job of the media. The job of the media is to ferret out the truth and to give you the tools to understand. So, you know, there's so much wrong with the way that NPR, New York Times, and many corporate and otherwise mainstream media sources treat these issues. And in part, it's because they're afraid of the right wing and they're not doing their job as journalists.
Rewire, you run Rewire. Where else do you go for news on this?
I read a wide range of different publications. Of course, I read all the mainstream media. I read Huffington Post and The Intercept and Atlantic.
There's so much.
There's so many.
Well, definitely be sure to check out Rewire. It's an online publication focused on reproductive health, rights, and justice. Jody Jacobson is president and editor-in-chief. And tonight, she's participating in Forum for Choice. The Democrats running for governor will be there. Republicans declined the invitation. John Chang, Delaine Easton, Gavin Newsom, Antonia Villaraigosa. It's from 6 to 8 at SoMart's Cultural Center. Find more information at yourcallradio.org. You can also watch the live stream. Jody, it's so nice to meet you in person.
It's great to be here.
Thank you so much.
I can't tell you how excited I am.
Thank you so much for coming in. Thank you so much for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.
President Trump has trade on his mind.
We have to have reciprocal trade. It's not a one-way deal anymore.
And bipartisanship.
Hopefully, the Democrats will join us, or enough of them will join us, so we can really do something great.
Trump says that's what we'll hear in his very first State of the Union speech. I'm Ari Shapiro. Live coverage this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered tonight at this afternoon at 3, and then we start covering the State of the Union at 5:30.